Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Blogcast. It's January 18, 2016, and this is episode 506. Today, I bring you a wonderful conversation with my good friend David Duchemin to talk initially about his new series of 20 video tutorials called After the Camera. As you might imagine, we go on to talk about all kinds of stuff, some incredibly profound and some light-hearted and fun. I won't spill the beans right now though, so let's jump in and enjoy my conversation with David Duchemin. Hi David, and welcome to back to the show. It's lovely to speak with you again.
Hi Martin, how are you?
I'm doing great, thanks. We've just been messing around with our audio, trying to get ready for this. One of the reasons that I've got a bit of stuff, some toys to play with, is because I've now got this mixer thing that, you know, Sharky from Sharky James from the Petapixel podcast.
I do, in fact.
Yeah, he got me onto this this idea of putting the audio through a mixer, so I can now do really weird stuff like this.
Monster truck race, monster truck. Yeah. I have to do it just by myself and just sound like an idiot. But nice that there's technology there with that.
You know, the first thing that came to mind when I started playing around with this cheesy echo is us standing in a bathroom in Hokkaido three years ago, and you doing your bow, chicka, bow, bow.
It would have been so much cooler with that.
I couldn't resist that. It's one of those things. Playing with toys, that's great. So, David, we haven't spoken for a while. It's great to be back on the show with you, and we're going to talk about your new video project that you've just released, After the Camera. So I've seen the preview and the chapter that you've put out as a teaser, and I love it. I think you've done a really good job, as you would only expect, but it's really down to earth. It's just like, I mean, you say it's like sitting down for 4.5 hours with you as you process your images. And I think it's going to be really valuable for anyone that picks it up. So I'm looking forward to talking about it today.
Thank you.
So tell us, I mean, if you give us an outline, what is After the Camera all about, just in your own words?
Yeah, I like to think that it's a simplified approach to everything that happens, you know, once the cameras go back in the bag. And so it's 20 short-ish episodes. Like anything I did, it ran well over time. Mm-hmm. I thought it would be 20 sort of, you know, 10-minute videos, and it came close to being 20-minute videos, but it's mostly, it's 20, 10 minutes worth of content, but then I talk a lot. So, but really my intention was to create something that talked about the way that I do things. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there that's very encyclopedic. It like goes through everything you can do in Lightroom. But the reality is I don't actually use, as a working professional, I don't use a lot of the stuff in Lightroom. And I think people get easily overwhelmed and think, gosh, if I can't learn all of this stuff, what hope have I got? And so I wanted to sort of put something out there that said, look, this is the way I do it. And it's certainly good enough for me to know, you know, maybe only half of what Lightroom does. Now, if I need to know where it is, I know how to learn it and I know how to figure it out. But the reality is for so much of what I do, I use the basic stuff. I'm into Lightroom. I'm out of Lightroom. I don't use, you know, at one point I was talking about importing, and I don't talk a lot about importing an organization, but I certainly talk about it. And then I get as quickly as I can into the develop module. But I was talking about keywording, and I sort of had to just be honest and go, you know what? I don't actually do a lot of keywording. I probably should, but I don't. So here's, you know, if you were to keyword, here's what I can tell you about it. But for me, keywording is not important. And I think it's important for people to understand Lightroom, like anything else, is a tool, and you've got to use it the way that you've got to use it. And just because there is keywording there, it doesn't mean you should use it if it's not helpful for you. And more to the point, you probably shouldn't feel guilty every time you open Lightroom and see that import dialog and think, oh God, I'm still not keywording. Well, look, if it doesn't help you, don't use it. Mm. You know, life's too short. And so I created this sort of as a simplified, honest, here's how I use Lightroom. And there are probably some power users that'll you know, why they would buy the product, I don't know, but they would look at it and go, man, this guy doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. Well, actually, I really do know what I'm talking about, but I don't know every tool, and where I don't know it and don't use it, I just don't show it. And I say, look, you know, this is not a tool I find helpful. My ability in, for example, sharpening in Lightroom, I you know how I feel about sharpening. If sharpening is the tool that's going to carry the image, I probably haven't made the best photograph. And so, you know, I should probably just delete the damn thing. So my approach to sharpening is actually very simplified. That doesn't mean that there's not some people out there that really know sharpening, and I could probably benefit from it, but I still haven't found a use for, you know, 20 different kinds of sharpening. I do what I need to, and then when I print it, I sharpen it with print sharpening, and I'm satisfied with that. So it's a simple, honest approach, and yeah, it's like sitting down with me for 4.5 hours, only you get to tell me when to shut up, and so it's broken into, you know, bite-sized pieces.
Yeah. And that really comes across in the way you've put it together. I've only seen one chapter, as it were, but it was just like that, and I'm totally with you. You know, I am very similar. I know Lightroom well. I've been using it since the beta, and I think that it's probably for me still the best tool for what we're doing. But I don't use every single tool, and I don't think that there's that many photographers that have to. So yeah, I mean, I keyword, but I'm not fanatical about keywording. I mean, I know that some people say, oh, yeah, you create these like nests of keywords, and you have these you put one in and it automatically puts in a million other keywords for you based on that. And I think if, you know, I'm probably going to get some heat for this as well, but I think if the only way you can get people to find your images and actually be, you know, moved at all by your images is because of some invertebrate keywording or something like that, it probably means that you failed with the image in the first place. So, you know, I really don't care about putting out every keyword. And I use keywords as a tool. And this is maybe what you do as well. But if I want to find something, I just put in, say, for example, I come back from the snow monkeys with a bunch of snow monkey photos. I'll put the keyword snow monkey in there. And that's about it. You know, I'll maybe put in snow and a few others. But I'm also doing that partly because of the fact that the work goes off to offset, and I know that you work with offset as well.
I do.
But the thing is an offset for the audience is a stock agency, but they also keyword, you know. So
exactly.
one of the beauties of working with a high end stock agency is that they're going to look at the images, and if they think that they need more keywords in there, they'll do it for us. So,
and better than I could. They understand the marketing.
Exactly.
So the only reason I would cut keyword really is for my own use in finding the image. And I have other ways of doing that. So, you know, but again, there are people like Seth Resnick. He's got an incredible hierarchy of keywording. And I went to Antarctica with him and a couple other guys, and he did a whole thing on keywording. And my eyes kind of glossed over, and I thought, my God, I don't even know where I would begin with this or where I would, but some people were eating it up. And so again, I would go back to that assertion that if it's a tool you need, figure out how to use it and use it to the best of your ability. But it, like camera calibration, I haven't used the camera calibration palette in Lightroom until very recently, when suddenly I realized, okay, I can use my Fuji cameras, I can set them to Velvia, and then later when I bring up that raw image, I can go into the camera calibration, pick that profile, and boom, it just gives me that look back again. I didn't, until I realized, you know, what I could do with that and started shooting with the Velvia film emulation and with the Fujis, it never occurred to me to even use it. And until then, I was quite happy just never opening it. So there's no, you know, if you don't need a tool, there's There's no need to feel guilty about the fact that, you know, you don't, frankly, I mean, there are tools I just go, I haven't got the foggiest idea how to use that. And I feel okay about that.
That's another thing that I teach in my Pixels to Pigment workshop about the, the calibration and how you can use the color checker passport to get totally accurate color. But the cameras are so good now that I think it was more useful years ago when the cameras were spewing out less, high fidelity or whatever, the images were flatter and lacked contrast. But all of the cameras that we're shooting with these days, the images come out of them looking great anyway. And so obviously we can then use that as a base to take it further in the workflow, but I honestly don't use the color checker passport anywhere near as much as I used to. The only time I use it now is if I'm working in the studio and I have to get something exactly keyed in. But in nature, I haven't used that for quite a while now. So, and that's probably will get me in trouble with the X-Rite people because I'm a Colorati member and they're probably thinking, why are you saying that, Martin? But the truth is that I keep it as a tool in my digital toolbox. And once you've created a profile, you apply it via the calibration panel that you were just talking about. But I just don't do it anywhere near as much as I used to. So, we're on the same page there again. It's I know about it, but I don't necessarily, it doesn't mean that I have to use it. So
I think my favorite part of that, Martin, is that you just said a member of the Colorati?
Yeah.
It sounds like you're a member of some crazy cult.
Well, that's what they call their band of merry men that go around the world talking about color management and stuff like that. And I don't want to put that down because I am very much the color management aspects as far as getting the monitor correct, showing you the correct colors, and the printing it's vitally important.
Absolutely.
But I just think that from the image has become a little bit overkill. And in natural subjects, if you apply a profile from the color checker passport, there's not that many natural subjects now that are going to really, really benefit from that. And so this comes back to a phrase that I often use that I've been thinking of since we started talking here. And that's that I'm not into jumping through loops that don't need to, or hoops that don't need to be jumped through. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something that's coming out as a common factor from both of us here.
Well, I think so. And I approach my stuff more as, art not with a capital A, but in terms of it being very subjective. And I think now that we're talking about the subject, I go through 20 episodes of After the Camera and don't even talk about, I don't mention color in reference to accuracy because it makes no sense whatsoever in the kind of the world that I operate in. Of course, if I were doing some kind of product photography, accuracy would in fact be relevant. But everything else is for me is a matter of interpretation because I approach my photography very much interpretively rather than as an illustration. And so if you want accuracy, you're probably going to go to a different photographer anyway because half of my stuff is blurry and subject to my own interpretation. And so accuracy actually is the very last thing I'm concerned about. But as you said, I think when that's the in-camera work, the after the camera work, when you get to making sure that you profile calibrate your monitor and that you're getting accurate from the work all that work you do in Lightroom, the last thing you want to do is then print something and have the colors be different than what you intended. For me, that's very much it's a significant concern.
Exactly. So yeah, the computer side is important, but I think that that actually get keen in the image, the accuracy of the image color is not something that we feel is that important. So let's get back to After the Camera. What I'll do is I'll just for the sake of the listeners, I'll put a few links in the blog post, and this blog post I believe will be at mbp.ac/506, and I'll put some links in there and maybe you know, we'll get people over to your website, of course, to pick this up. But I looked through the chapter that you've put on your own blog, and I'm sure people have already seen this anyway. But you were going through some very specific local adjustments, and you used a number of tools that, you know, some people aren't going to be aware of. Some of them are new in recent versions of Lightroom. So can you tell us a little bit about what, you know, in this, I think it was the Spirit Bear video. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about some of the tools that you used in there.
Yeah, so it's episode 13, and Martin, feel free to, you know, to link that in your show notes. There's, I don't know if it's a Vimeo, it's probably a Vimeo video, but just, you know, either embed it or put the link in for people to watch the whole episode. But the basic, after the camera basically walks through what I call my vision-driven workflow, and there are several steps. The first is identifying intent. The second is minimizing distraction. The third is maximizing the mood. And the fourth is drawing the eye. And then the fifth is refining for output. And in that fourth step, drawing the eye, that's where, after all my global adjustments are done, that's where I ask, you know, is the eye of the person reading my photograph, is it going where I want to? And how can I push and pull the eye subtly to increase that experience, prolong the visual journey through that photograph? And so Lightroom has a couple of really great tools, starting with the gradient filter, which I think is really good for not only for maximizing mood and, you know, bringing back skies and stuff, but doing sort of a very subtle push and pull, darkening things, lightening things, but then getting a little bit more granular, the adjustment brush, and my new favorite, which I didn't even understand when this damn thing came out. When the radial filter first came out, I was like, I don't understand how to use this friggin' thing. In part because, you know, you create this little circle, and inside the circle, you can darken things or lighten things, or, and this is the default of Lightroom, that the adjustment you make is by default not inside the circle, but is outside the circle. And in order to get the effect, the change to happen inside the circle you've just created, you have to invert the mask, which is just, to me, it's totally ludicrous.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you've just created a circle, and now Lightroom thinks you want everything except inside the circle to, anyway, once you kind of wrap your mind around it, and all you need to do is spend 5 minutes screwing around with it and, you know, all of the changes you make in a photograph are non-destructive anyway. So you open a picture, you open the radial filter, and you say, all right, let's figure this thing out. Mm-hmm. Once I got a handle on it, it has sort of replaced so much of the work that I do with the adjustment brush, because it allows me to, for example, to select a face and to do it in I use a very feathered kind of selection. Mm. But it closely imitates the way light works anyway. Light is not often that specific that, you know, you want to just paint in little bits and pieces. And I still use the adjustment brush to dodge and burn, but more often now I'm using the radial filter on a really feathered kind of setting and just kind of creating these kind of zones of dodge and burn rather than sort of very specifics. And actually it's much faster, but I think it's a little bit more natural, only because I tend to be a little heavy-handed at first with the adjustment brush. I tend to, you know, be real nitpicky and a bit of a perfectionist, whereas the radial filter allows me to kind of just, I think it's a little more subtle, and I love the radiator, the radiator filter. It's new on Chevrolets and Fords, and the radial filter, especially for, you know, for things like slightly lightening a face or the body of a person, or for just sort of darkening areas where maybe a graduated filter wouldn't work, or an adjustment brush would just maybe take too long, because the adjustment brush gives you so many options that you kind of tend to screw around, and then you're erasing bits and adding bits. And I find the adjustment brush really great. But also, when I bought my latest iMac, my Wacom tablet stopped working and I can't get a driver for it. Hmm. So I either have to, the writing's on the wall, I have to go and buy a new Wacom tablet, which is so pissed me off that, as a matter of principle, I kind of put the thing in a drawer and just said, well, to hell with it, I'm just not going to use one for a while. Mm-hmm. I'm getting the point now where I've got to go and buy a new tablet because I like my Wacom tablet.
Yeah,
but that radial filter is so good At least, you know, for the style of work that I do in terms of pushing and pulling the eye, darkening bits and lightening bits, that I do a lot of that in combination with the adjustment brush to sort of dodge and burn.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm totally with you. I have only really used the radial filter on faces. And you said that you like it, you know, using it on portraits. But I think I've used it on a few other images. I definitely don't use it as much as you, but when I have used it, I certainly agree that it feels more natural. The local adjustments, you know, the adjustment brush is it paints where you click and drag your mouse around, but that's really closely tied to a human movement. And I think that the radial filter probably emulates more what cameras do. It's more like a vignette, but you can place it anywhere you want, right?
Exactly. And that's another way that I've started using it is I like my post-crop vignette, and I still tend to default to it. But halfway through using it, I realized, you know, actually, I keep trying to remind myself the radial filter does a better job because I can place that vignette very accurately compared to a post-crop where really it just has to be in the middle.
Yeah, yeah. I have some photos from Namibia this year of some of the Himba people inside their huts. And if I recall, I took a radial filter and just darkened down around the people because they're already in a very dark environment, but you could see more of it than I wanted to. And so I was darkening down the edges a lot, but very specifically right where their face is. And so, yeah, it sounds like a similar sort of thing. But I also noticed in your Spirit Bear video that you used it to, you know, you were lightening not only the bear, but you did some work on the tree in the background there as well. And I thought that that sort of emulated a splash of light hitting part of the tree, but not the rest of it, and provided a lot of great balance for the image. So I think that the way you're using it, it's obviously you're a very creative person, and I think that it will hopefully open up doors. I mean, even for me, I don't think of that stuff in my images. I tend to work more generically. So I think that even for me, but also hopefully for some of the listeners, it's the sort of thing that they'll be taking away from after the camera that will hopefully lead to an improvement in not only how they use Lightroom, but the resulting photographs. And that's the most important part after all.
Mm-hmm. And I think it will. I think it could be. Here's a question. Did you do a lot of or any time in the traditional wet darkroom?
I have only just over this in 2015 developed my first roll of film. So,
congratulations! you have a chemically induced life ahead of you. I haven't been in darkroom for ages, but I cut my teeth in the darkroom, the traditional wet darkroom, and I think the radial filter is the reason the reason I like it so much is that it is so much more like the traditional, the dodging and burning in the traditional wet darkroom, where you would have a little pieces of cardboard stuck to a coat hanger and pieces of cardboard with holes cut out. And you would sort of do this little kind of feathered dance with those to lighten and darken. And I think the radial filter kind of does that. So one of the things that I'm hoping through this video series, although I didn't talk about the traditional darkroom because most people don't have that point of reference, is talking about it really not in terms of fixing our images, but reassigning visual mass. So you mentioned brightening up a spot on the leaves that was kind of above this spirit bear in episode 13. And for me, that was a very natural extension of the techniques I learned in the wet darkroom. I wasn't fixing the image and I didn't need to be really specific about it. I just wanted to generally, as you said, actually much more eloquently than I would have put it, just replicate sort of a splash of light on those trees. And that radial filter, now that I've started playing with it, has probably become one of my favorite tools in Lightroom to very quickly, as I said, kind of reassign the visual mass, give to some areas of the image greater visual pull, and some areas reduce that pull so that, the eye flows where we as, visual storytellers want it to go.
Yeah, yeah. I recently read The Negative, Ansel Adams' The Negative. Mm-hmm. And in there, you know, I mean, people have always said that from digital, you know, the traditionalists will say, oh, digital's killing photography because, you know, people are playing with their images too much and all of this. It's just the thing is that the tools are there now to make it so much easier for people to abuse the technology. But Ansel Adams in The Negative talks about how he takes, I quoted it in a recent blog post and podcast, but his images were his representation of how he wanted things to look. He never said that his images were an accurate representation of the world around us. And so I think that it all comes down to us. You know, years ago, I was more of a traditionalist, and I would basically, what comes out of the camera is what people see. But that's why my photography wasn't that good for a long time. You know, I think that we have to, you know, the base image is very important. You know, I'm a stickler for quality. I always want to get the best base image, but I don't think that has to be where it finishes. And the sort of work that you're doing in after the camera is really going to show people that sort of thing. And I mean, it's like in Silver Effects Pro, I use control points quite a lot to do similar things. I'll lighten certain areas, I'll dodge and burn, as it were, and I'll do all that sort of thing. And I don't think for one moment that my black and white images represent an accurate view of the world. And for one thing, there are not that many of us that see in black and white. But I'll increase the contrast, I'll do all sorts. And I just think that it's really important for people to realize that if you want to create art rather than just a documentation of the world, then these things are totally acceptable and recommended in many ways.
Well, absolutely. In fact, you know, there is no such thing as an accurate view of the world. And I've been saying this for a long time. You know, someone once interviewed me and said, how do you, given the stories that you tell, how do you stay objective? And I said, I stay objective. The last thing I want is to be objective. In fact, I pursue subjectivity. In fact, I believe that art, in order to be art, has to have an element of interpretation. It is not just, I mean, cameras, otherwise we may as well just put our camera on a scooter and get it to do time lapse and, you know, tour the neighborhood and just take pictures of whatever. In order to move people, you have to sort of not only just show them something, but kind of tell them, put a filter on the front of it and say, this is the way I see it. Not this is what I'm looking at, but this is the way I see it. And I think I like tradition. I'm a big fan of tradition. I'm not a big fan of traditionalism. But I think it's really important that we learn from tradition, that we learn the tools and the techniques. But I think the quote you're probably alluding to, and I can't do it justice either, but Ansel basically said that the negative is the score and the print is the performance, relating it to sort of an orchestral or a musical analogy. And I think that's an excellent way of looking at it, because even a score gets interpreted by a musician, and all of our stuff should be, you know, the last thing I want to do is look at art that is or strives to be objective, you know, that is free from the human opinion. Or, I mean, that's one of the problem with news these days, is everything pretends to be objective. We all, of course, know it's not. And in the course of it, we lose the humanity. You know, the last thing in the world I want to do is see one more newscaster with a straight face tell me about some horror that's happened somewhere in the world, completely divorced of any kind of human emotion, or even explaining the context of it, or you know, shedding a tear over the total horror of it. I'm not interested in objectivity. So I think the sooner photographers abandon that as a, even journalists, I don't think that there is objectivity in journalism. The minute you put a 16 millimeter lens on instead of a 35, or a 50 on instead of a 24, you are cropping in camera and saying this part of the story matters, this part doesn't. And you can either tell beautiful truths with that, or you can manipulate the scenario to tell any lie you want. So I've kind of a little bit, I think, moved on from some of these arguments about whether Photoshop is good or not. It's a question of, do you trust the storyteller? Because the tools have always been there. I mean, let's face it, even with 4x5 view cameras and a basic wet darkroom, the camera would tell any lie you asked of it. And there are lots of, I mean, photographs have been used by the Third Reich and by every possible racist organization and or religion and or insert thing here that people are telling stories about. Some of them true, some of them not, but it has nothing to do really with the technology. It has everything to do with whether we trust the guy that's wielding the camera or the Wacom pen or the traditional darkroom tools.
Yeah. No, that's such a great point.
I just went off, didn't I? You need a buzzer that's like, beep.
No, I'd never stop you. We could sit here for 3 hours and it would all be worth it. That wasn't actually the quote, but I need to look it up. But it was just really... I mean, I've heard that before, and I think that that is also exactly what I mean. And that, you know, what you say in there, the whole thing, that's the point I was trying to make as well, and that it's been manipulating images has been around since the start of the medium. So, all great points. But the last thing that you said there about trust, that to me is what really what it all comes down to. And I'd not really thought of it that way, but yeah, so well put. I think that, you know, I often talk about trust in the, or with regards to critique. You know, I think that it's so important to have someone that is, the trusted critique. And I think that that's really the reverse of that. You know, whether you trust the person who's wielding the Wacom pen, like you say. So yeah, very, very well put. I'll have to remember that. So we've talked about tools that we like in Lightroom, which I think this could be a loaded question. I almost know exactly what you're going to say, but which tool do you dislike the most in Lightroom? And not so much like just finding something to pound on, but Is there a certain feature or the way something works in Lightroom that you just can't figure out?
Oh, what I can't figure out is how the guy that created the healing and cloning tool still kept his job.
That's what I knew you were going to say.
Those tools blow my mind. You know, guys, it's mind blowing. It really is. I was working on something today and I could not. Photoshop has the same tools and works beautifully. And Lightroom has allegedly the same tools. And it just makes me want to bang my head against the wall. It's ridiculous. I could go on a rant about this. I'm going to refrain because I don't have the words. Because I knew we would be speaking, I want to honor your Japanese citizenship. I'm drinking a Japanese whiskey, and the further into our conversation that I go, the closer to the bottom of the glass I get. So I want to be careful. I don't go off on a rant for which I have no words, but that particular tool drives me crazy. The other thing that drives me crazy is why we can't have some kind of flexibility with the gradient tool. You know, we have it in Photoshop and we can have radial gradients and we can have reverse gradients, and why we can't have something beyond just the very basic no options gradient filter, I don't know. But, you know, at the same time, I think creativity always works within constraints. And if one tool doesn't do the job for us, instead of bitching about it, you just find a more creative way around it and figure out how to do what you need to do. So,
well, maybe that's what you've done with the radial tool. Yeah, it's you can use it in similar ways, but I agree. But I knew you were going to say that about the clone tool. It's crazy, isn't it? You click somewhere and it goes off and finds the absolute worst place to clone in. And you pretty much always end up having to move it around.
Do you know what it is? It's exactly like the defaults on the radial filter. It says to itself, how can I do this exactly the opposite of what he wants? And there should be just a thing that says, you know, reverse the default. And then boom, it would find exactly the perfect thing. But instead, what it does is find the area in your image that is most unlike the thing that you're trying to fix. And it's totally ridiculous. But again, on the plus side, to look at it positively, Lightroom has made me a much better photographer. Knowing that it is such a pain in the ass to fix stuff like that, I prefer to get things right in camera, and I have become a much less lazy photographer now that I use Lightroom instead of Photoshop, because Photoshop, I really could just, quote, fix it in Photoshop quite easily. I almost never go into Photoshop now, and so knowing the limitations of Lightroom has made me, and printing at once, now that I print and look at my work, the larger I print it and the more diligently I look at my work, the more carefully I tend to my craft, because those two tools together have made me much more diligent and much less lazy about my craft. And so, for that alone, I would be grateful to Lightroom for not getting it right and giving me tools that actually work.
Yeah, and I totally agree. I think that for printing, of course, you know, just the act of putting it down on paper, if for nothing else, you'll find all of the flaws in the image that you didn't really know about. But I think that there's just something about holding that tactile print once it comes out of the printer, that it's almost like, you know, going back to the darkroom and actually creating. The only way to view images years ago, unless you wanted to, and slides, you know, slides and aside. But if you were shooting with negative film, the only way to really view them was to print them. And I think that's something that we've missed for the last sort of decade as digital photography came in. But there are a lot more people printing now, and it's, you know, it's great to hear you talking about those benefits as well.
I love it. I every time I go to IKEA, I end up buying more. They have these little shelves that you can screw to your wall that will hold prints, and you can just swap them in, and, you know, and increasingly I'm just filling them up with photographs, and in part because I want to live with my work. Yeah. I also have a big cable hanger in my office where I hang prints that I've just printed, and I look at them for a while, and there's always a red marker or a Sharpie somewhere where I can circle bits I've missed, dust spots, or, you know, I think I've done a really great job on something, and after 2 days of looking at it, I see some glaringly obvious halo or some artifacting that I just, you know, it blows me away that I missed it. But, you know, I've seen stuff out there in books and on websites from professionals that I've also missed it, and their stuff is out there, and it's out there with big sensor spots, and I think, God, if for only that reason, printing your stuff and living with it so that you can perfect your work and maybe give it the honor that it's due, and to hold it. You know, you mentioned just touching the stuff. We're in danger of getting to the point where we never hold our own work and never get to the point where we have to choose a paper based on the haptic qualities of the paper and the way that it feels in our hand. And I think that's a great loss. I think there's something beautiful when what we create is not just art, but is artifact, you know, and you can actually, in fact, hold it and touch it and give it, you know, give it to someone to put on their walls.
Yeah. You know, I so envy you having, you know, living in a country where people can buy their own homes more easily. I haven't owned my own home since I was a kid. Like literally, I bought a house when I was 19. It's the only one I've ever owned, and I sold that many years ago. So now here in Japan, I can't make like holes in the walls and things. I can put photos up because we can use the little pin hook things with the tiny pins on the back. But I'd love to be able to put shelves up and a proper wire system and stuff. But I do my fair share of printing, though. I have, you know, as people have seen on the videos I sometimes put out, I've got images all on the walls. I just really envy you for being able to put up shelves and do all of that stuff.
Well, to be fair, Martin, I don't own my own home. I rent, and every time I leave, I just make sure I patch up the holes. you know, and or I put up such good shelving that when I leave, the landlord wants me to leave it there. okay. So, you know, there are ways around this. But, you know, even if you own or you don't own your home, there must be, I mean, because your office is a great example. You've got art on the walls. And if all you can do is hang one thing, then hang one really, really gigantic piece of blank something and pin photographs to that. But you, whatever it is, whatever your constraint even if it's, you know, I put a sheet of glass over your desk and put prints underneath it and live with them there. It's, I think photographers, I hear all the time two things. One is the, you know, I've spent so much money on gear, now I can't afford to travel. And I think, well, that's a ridiculous, I mean, spend less money on gear, sell that, some of that stuff and go travel, because if that's what you want to photograph, better to do it with, heck, a Fuji X100, no new lenses needed. Mm. Just go out and make photographs. Mm. But better to do that. And then people that say, you know, and now I can't afford to, like, oh, I wish I could afford to print. I'm spending all my money on lenses and stuff. Well, that's a little like buying an electric guitar and spending so much money on strings you can't afford an amplifier. Well, yeah, I think the one is actually absolutely necessary. I don't think we should be, should is the wrong word. I think we benefit strongly by having physical prints and actually seeing the creative process through to the point where we bring stuff into the world. You know, and the stuff on your walls is a great example. I mean, it's beautiful stuff and it's inspiring, but I tell you what, it's a huge impact compared to looking at it on a laptop. I mean, I've seen your work on your walls and I've seen your work on the laptop. It looks beautiful on the laptop, but when you see it, because there's something about scale, right? I mean, right. When you're printing, you're making a decision. Do I print this 4x6 or do I print it 20x20x30 or 40x60? Mm. Because scale matters and that has impact. And if we're not, if we're removing ourselves from a context in which we would even ever have to make those decisions, we're going to be reduced to our art only living on a photo shelter portfolio. And that would be, as beautiful as those portfolios are, that would be a truly unfortunate thing.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, years ago, I bought, remember when photo frames first started come out, those digital photo frames where you put a memory card in and it's like an iPad, but it was the only thing it could do was to display photos.
Right.
I gave in to the temptation many years ago when those first came out, and I brought it home, set it up, and put a memory card in with like a few of my probably, I don't know, 50 or 60 of my best shots at the time. And I think it stayed on for about 3 or 4 days, and it would sort of sense when you're around and show you the images. And there's, if that's all it can do, I ended up just putting it back in the box, and it was the stupidest thing I've ever bought. Well, I've bought other things that perhaps stupider, but you know,
I wish I could say that a digital photo frame was the stupidest thing that I had ever bought.
But yeah, it just comes back to your point there. You know, there's something about the size of a good print, and I think that they really are something that people should, you know, like you just corrected yourself there as well. Again, I don't like to say should, but I think that there is definitely something that people can benefit from printing. And even if it's like the 13x19 printers are the most that some people will be able to aspire to, they're still quite expensive. They're not ridiculously expensive, but even 13x19 with a little bit of a border, you hold that in your hand and it makes you feel totally different about your images. So it's mm-hmm. great topic. Coming back to something that you mentioned about the dust spots on images, it's really weird, but I've noticed over the last couple of years that some people just don't see them. And to me, they jump out at me. If I open an image and there's a dust spot, sometimes it has to be in the print, but they sort of jump out to us. But I've spoken with people over the last few years, usually in a sort of a mentoring situation, where I'll point it out to them. There's like a dust spot in the middle of the photo, or two or three of them right in key places. And they'll say, you know, I hadn't even noticed that. And so I don't know if it's just practice or becoming accustomed to seeing these things, but there's definitely some certain people that just don't notice them, which is, I find strange, but I don't quite know why that is.
Well, I think I do. It's people don't pay attention, and you know, it's the idea of seeing the forest for the trees, or whatever that expression is. You know, I think we need to be critical of our own work, and when you don't print your work, there's a good enough for Instagram mentality, And, you know, I think you and I have probably joked about the concept of monitor shock. Man, it looks so good on that LCD on the back of the camera. And then when you put it on a big monitor, you sort of experience that, oh, crap, you know, it's the image is deficient in one way or another that doesn't, you know, I'm okay if it's not perfectly sharp for a particular reason. And that enforces my aesthetic desires for the image. But if it works against it, there are times you just have to go, you know what? Swing and miss. And I was lazy and I didn't pay attention and I didn't get it right. And I think some people, A, they're not there yet. And B, they, because they're not printing, maybe all they see their images on is an 11-inch MacBook. They're never seeing them at 100%. And really, do we really want to look that closely, or do we just want to fire it up onto social media and move on? It depends what your goals for your craft are. But my sense is with the popular photography movement that it is very much, I just post the image and move on. And I'm arguing for sort of a slow food movement version of photography where you slow it down and you print your stuff and you live with it. And when you screw it up, you go back and do it again. It's not the most popular. It's counterintuitive for today when, you know, everything's about megapixels and about how great our technology is. And I would argue, you know what, screw the technology. It's certainly very helpful at times, but there's no substitute for you printing your stuff and or not, but sitting at 100% and looking at your image, like really paying attention and just going, is my craft equal to my vision? You know, I'm not the guy to argue about sharpening and, you know, some people think I could care less about that. I actually care a great deal about it. I want my craft to serve my vision. And if it does, great. But too often, I think we just get lazy. You know, and I, of course, I'm guilty of it too. There have been images that I thought I had looked at, and I just really carefully looked at the parts I wanted to see and missed something. Sometimes we do, but also if we are less concerned about putting out hundreds and hundreds of images every year, and maybe concentrated on, you know, 3 or 4 dozen images that we really like, or, you know, heck, 100 would be slowing down for some people. Over the course of a year, they come back from a day of shooting egrets in a swamp in Florida, and they make me look at every damn one of those photographs, thousands, you know, and how can you critically look at 100 photographs in a day when most of us, you know, we take a lot longer just to deal with one photograph. So it could be a cultural thing, and there are maybe not enough voices saying, hey, we can do better than this.
Yeah. You know, I think that I remember a few years ago realizing that, I think I mentioned this in a post that it was the evolution of the photographer, something like that. I think that when you first start doing photography and for a number of years, we view the images that we are creating as the prizes. It's payment for having spent the time to go out. So if someone's going to spend a whole day of their life in a swamp in Florida, they've got to have something to show for it. And I think that drives the early, you know, or the less experienced photographer to want to pick something out. You've got to get 1 or 2 minimum photos that you can show people. And I think that at even earlier stages, that's what drives people to try and show you 1,000 photographs of those egrets. And it's this concept of needing some sort of a reward for the effort that you put in. And I think it takes a certain amount of confidence in your work and in yourself as a photographer to be able to come back from a shoot. And if you didn't get anything that really is compelling, then to just say, okay, well, I screwed up there, I messed up, I don't have anything to show for the day, I learned a few things, but that's about it, and just sort of push it aside. You know, of course, the next step to that is to not come away with nothing. You know, to actually make something when you put the effort in to go out. But I think that it's something to do with probably confidence and experience to actually be able to come away from a shoot either with something to show for each shoot that you do that really is compelling, or have the guts to just say, well, you know, there really isn't a lot to show from that. But I think that that's the driving force behind that. People need some sort of a compensation or a prize for their efforts.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think, again, it's indicative of the photographic culture that we live in, because I would argue at this stage when, you know, I'm 30 years in as a photographer, yes, I want to come back with something that I can show. Mm. But the greatest thing I can come back with is having learned something, because I am not a master of this craft. I will never be a master, and it's a journey. And so if I can come back from something, yes, I would love it if something that I photographed made me happy and made me sort of think, you know what, this is good, in the truest sense of the word. But there are still going to be 350 or 800 images that don't make the cut. And the big question is, rather than, you know, select all, delete, the big question is, what can I learn from this? How can these, because I paid a price for them, yeah, my time, my money, my, you know, my attention, how can these instruct me? Because they're failures, and failures are always our best instructors. Mm. And what can I learn? For what could I have done better? How could this have been stronger? Okay, it doesn't do anything for you. Noted. All right. But don't just hit, you know, X and then delete all. Look at it and say, what could I have done to make this one better? Was it my POV? Should I have been a little lower? Was it my choice of optics? What was it that I could have done to make this stronger? Was it just a reframing that I could have done? Was it a choice of moment? But learning from that, so when, as you pointed out, when you go back, you have an opportunity to try and do again, rather than this sort of this, I guess it's about process versus product, mm-hmm, you know, that you come back with this, I have 10 shots to validate the fact that I'm a good photographer. Well, I'm doing this 30 years and I've gone to entire countries and come back with nothing. You know, I think I have one photograph from Laos and Cambodia combined that's kind of, maybe if I was honest, it's maybe a 3-star. Mm-hmm. Maybe if I apply a better tone curve and pump the clarity, it might go up to 4 stars, you know, but it's crap. It's just crap. And no matter what I do in Lightroom, I'm just polishing a turd. But rather than waste that, of course, I had a great experience. Go back and look at the images and go, okay, what was it? How can I learn something about myself, my creative process? And maybe it is just I need a new tool in Lightroom to come up, and, you know, suddenly I hit the unsuck filter. And of course, the problem was with the unsuck filter is everything outside the circle would unsuck, and the bit that I really want to unsuck, I'd have to invert the mask, and then it would be, you know, be like auto unsuck. That's the other tool that gets me crazy, auto tone. Oh, yeah.
I think
on the days it gets it right, I swear there's some kind of magic happening. But the rest of the time, I swear to God, it's just out to get me.
I used it years ago. I mean, when digital, I think it was with the D30, like cost me half a house. But
D30, my God, was that a wood burning camera?
It had a hamster in the back running on a wheel to get the batteries going. It was a 3-megapixel. It was the first Canon digital SLR, and the images from that most of the time were really flat and lackluster. And I remember for a while I actually did apply, I think it was auto levels. It was before Lightroom, but I think I was applying auto levels in Photoshop, and it actually did a reasonable job of making the images a little bit more punchy. But yeah, in Lightroom, that I haven't clicked that, apart from to show people how bad it is. I haven't clicked that for years.
Well, there's value to that, right?
There
you
is.
Pull up your photograph, you're feeling bad about it, you're a little down on yourself. As an artist, you're going to that dark place. And then, you know, then you hit sort of the whole autocorrect, auto-tones thing, and you realize how truly worse it could be. You don't feel so bad about yourself. Exactly. You go back and you think, you know, it can always be worse.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, David, it's been wonderful speaking. What have you got coming up? Have you got any wonder? I know that you're at home at the moment, instead of traveling. What's next for you?
Yeah, I am. I'm unexpectedly at home, but things happen, and so I go to Africa, where I should be now. I go to I'll be in Nairobi at the end of January, and I'm guiding a safari there in Kenya's Masai Mara.
Nice.
And then I go for 8 days to Zanzibar to scuba dive and spend some time kind of relaxing and getting some more dives in. And then to Rajasthan in India for a week with some students. And then Cynthia and I go to Istanbul for a week just to kind of scout it out and make some photographs. And then we come home. And then I've got a lot of time this year. Just my big focus is going to be getting my cameras back underwater and photographing. I've got a great trip in June that I'm so excited about. One of the reasons I started scuba diving is because I wanted to be with, you know, the giant mantas and the hammerhead sharks and dolphins and like the big pelagic animals. And so I'm going to a place called Socorro in Mexico, which is about a 20-hour boat ride from Cabo San Lucas. And just spending like a full week diving all day, every day around these kind of underwater rock pinnacles that attract these giant mantas and schooling hammerheads and that sort of thing. So very excited about that. It's a little scary. You know, we've talked before about kind of the risk you take as an artist, and you have photographed wildlife for a long time, whereas I've gone from the humanitarian photographer who writes foolish things in his books that says, you know, I'm not much of a landscape photographer, and then suddenly I find myself doing landscapes more than almost anything else, and then, you know, saying something scathing about wildlife photographers and realizing that the bulk of my work over the last couple of years has in fact been wildlife. And so God only knows where I'm going over the next little while, or worse, what I'm going to do with these photographs. I keep going, you know, I know where I fit as a humanitarian photographer. I was just starting to get a handle as a landscape photographer, and now I'm making photographs of bears and sea lions 50 feet underwater, and kind of going, okay, what do I do with this? So it's always an adventure.
Well, you know, the great thing about that is that in true David Duchovny style, you're doing it so well, and I've really enjoyed watching. When we first got to know each other, you were already doing the landscape, or you'd started to, and it's been great watching that. But I saw your Spirit Bear photos, and I think it's probably the same one in your in after the camera. You're working on, I think it probably is the sea lions or a sea. There's a whole bunch of seals under the sea.
Yeah, and it's the sea lions.
That shot, it just blew me away. I'm like, okay, now I realize that, you know, you really are doing the wildlife stuff. So you don't do anything in halves. You throw everything into it, and that's why you're rewarded with the sort of images that you're getting. But
you know what? Yeah, thank you. I want to make a quick point here. I know exactly what you're saying, and I'm grateful. But the reward is actually the experience itself, and I think that's why my work is finally starting to work, at least for the wildlife stuff, because for a while I thought the reward was the photograph, and finally I realized, you know what, to hell with it. And I started to have fun, and I started to find the wonder and the magic. And suddenly, I mean, apart from the fact that I'm also finally figuring out how to focus this damn underwater camera and get the strobes where they need to be and all of that stuff, because I've gone back to I haven't even gone back to square one. I'm so far back, I am desperate to get to square one on this stuff. It's been an incredible learning curve, especially because, you know, you're not only trying to make a photograph, but you're trying to stay alive. It's just, you know, you're not thinking, okay, I just got to expose this. You're thinking, okay, don't die. Just try not to die. and then once you've done that, if you can expose it and focus it, it's icing on the cake.
Yeah.
But I appreciate you saying that. I am having that dive with the last dive with the sea lions was probably one of the most exciting moments of my life, to, you know, because you and I have been in the wild with, you know, penguins and monkeys and stuff that they're not offended by your presence. They're a little wary, but it's very rare that, in fact, I can say I've never been in true wilderness and had animals interact with me to the point that you know, they're chewing on my head and they're looking at their reflection like millimeters from the dome of my lens and really truly interacting with me. Very often they're sort of, you know, they're still in their own world looking at you. This was an experience with, you know, animals that frankly are bigger than grizzly bears when they're fully grown. Mm. And you're sitting there with, you know, three, four, or a dozen of them in front of your camera. Well, one is chewing on your fin and one is chewing on your head.
Yeah.
And you're going back to, okay, just don't die. Just don't die. You know, it's mind blowing. It is so much fun. And I think when you're having those, you know, I think it was Joe McNally said, you know, put yourself in front of more interesting things. And Jay Mizell said a similar thing. And the wisdom from photographers that have been there keeps coming back. Nobody is saying get the latest Nikon camera, as good as it may or may not be. Nobody is saying that's the secret to your photography. Mm. The wisdom of people that have been doing it for 30, 50 years is always the same. Put yourself in front of more interesting stuff, find new experiences and photograph that. And then, you know, and then apply lots and lots of clarity and saturation. You should be fine.
I've got to add a couple of things there. You've reminded me. I mean, I remember the last time I was in Antarctica, we had an encounter with some baby elephant seals. And those, you know, those guys are like 150 kilograms when they're 7 or 8 weeks old. And their mums are all out at sea catching fish. They leave them. They'll give birth to them. They'll wean them for a couple of weeks. And then they'll go back out to sea for another six to eight weeks to fatten up on fish and come back. And during that sort of period while the mums are away, the babies are lying around on the beach, absolutely dying to touch. You know, they're a tactile animal. They want to be in contact with things, and so although you've been down there, you know how it works. You're not allowed to approach a wild animal, but if you're sitting on a beach and they come to you, that's okay. And I remember being on a beach and just kind of hoping that this would happen. But a baby sea lion, elephant seal, came waddling over. They're like these big, like truck inner tubes full of oil, and and the great big glassy eyes. And one came over and started rolling around over me. And they're like, you know, those things. They could. One of our expedition leaders was. Had one actually rolling over his stomach, and the guy was in pain. You know, when you get something that big rolling around over you, it can be dangerous. That's probably the closest I've come to actually being injured by an animal. And I was almost eaten by lions in Namibia this year, but that's our truck broke.
Well, who hasn't?
I mean, our safari vehicle broke. No, well, it didn't break down. We got stuck in sand on a ramp on the way out of the Huanib River, and we had to get out and push when there's a pride of lions next to us. But luckily, they'd just taken a giraffe down, so they weren't interested in us so much, even though they were looking. But yeah, no, the point I was going to make there, and I'll get to it now, was that I don't have a single photograph of those elephant seals that I feel is worth showing anybody. But the experience stays with me, and it's a really, really precious memory. So totally with you on that as well.
And you'll bring that experience the next time you photograph elephant seals with a deeper understanding of behavior and a deeper understanding of your own feelings and thoughts towards them. Mm-hmm. And it may then be that, you know, you create this, you know, this body of work on elephant seals that, you know, that astonishes us. So I'm hesitant when I'm talking to young photographers to talk too much about gear because it's so irrelevant compared to some of this other stuff and that perspective and frankly, enjoyment of life. I mean, because at the end of the day, you may not come back from Namibia with a great photograph, but if you come back with a great story.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, no. Come back with a great story and a great photograph. And that is, as you said, you know, sort of the reward at the end of learning your craft toward the tail end of, figuring some of this stuff out, because there's so much to think about. I mean, it's that came home to me so strongly when I started doing this underwater stuff and realized a little bit about how some of my students must feel when they pick up a camera for the first time. And I'm telling them, okay, it's not that big a deal. All you have to do is think about exposure, you know, shutter, f-stop, focus, composition, not just composition, but balance, tension, color depth, you know, I could give them 30 things off the top of my head and go, you know, all you got to do is think about that stuff and make your photograph. I'm always amazed they don't just, you know, throw the camera down and go make macrame owls or something for the rest of their lives, because photography is challenging. Mm-hmm. You know, it's tough stuff, but if you can figure all that stuff out and have a great experience and have a great story, then I think that's what most of us get into photography for.
Absolutely. Well, I think we'll leave it at that. We can't wrap it up much better than that. Great thoughts there, David. And as usual, it's always a pleasure to speak. You know, either sitting on a bus in Hokkaido or on the podcast like this.
So, well, there's a lot less sake involved when you're on the podcast. But yeah, it's all, as always, an absolute pleasure, Martin. Thank you. It's I miss being in Hokkaido and Japan around this time of year with you.
Well, whenever you want to come back, just let me know. There's always a place for you.
Right on. Well, I appreciate that.
Did you ever patent that sake chiller that you invented last year? Remember that?
No, I'm just kind of keeping that to myself. I figured a plastic bag and a handful of snow was probably, it was a little overly ambitious to patent it. But, you know, if I can add a third, if I can add something else to it, like, you know, HDR photography and make an app out of it, I think I've got the path to riches.
Absolutely. You'll crack it one day, I'm sure. Oh, well, brilliant. Thanks so much, David. Just remind us, where can people find your work?
Yeah, my work is on my website at daviddusheman.com, and my teaching resources, including Photograph Magazine, that I am thrilled to have the elusive, but you're not really elusive, the illustrious Martin Bailey writing for Photograph Magazine. And the resource we were just talking about after the camera is at craftandvision.com, along with about 100 other resources, including a couple excellent Martin Bailey books. Making the Print I still refer to that when I'm printing Martin. I think Making the Print is an excellent resource. So if your readers haven't, you know, got a hold of that, it's really, truly well worth the ridiculously low amount of money that we charge for it.
Well, thanks very much for that. Yeah, okay. Well, brilliant. Thank you very much. And we'll hopefully hook up again for another conversation in the not too distant future.
My pleasure. We'll talk soon.
Bye-bye. As usual, that was just so much fun. I hope you enjoyed that conversation with David, as anywhere near as much as I did. So before we finish, I'd just like to say, you know, I'll put a blog post together for this. There are some links for you to follow. I'll link to the videos that we mentioned and to the After the Camera series. The blog post is going to be at mbp.ac/506. And I'd also like to quickly mention that I have now started to take bookings for the 2017 Hokkaido Winter Landscape Photography Adventure Tour that I'm actually on right now as I release this. We pre-recorded before I left, but it's an amazing opportunity to shoot some of the most beautiful minimalist winter landscapes on the planet, in my opinion. The weather fronts from Siberia beat down on Hokkaido in the wintertime, and it just makes it such a true winter wonderland. It's the same place that I take my winter wildlife tours, but we run different side of the island. For this tour, we really just concentrate on the landscape. And so if you are a landscape photographer, you're into minimalist, beautiful landscapes and say seascapes, then check this out at mbp.ac/HLPA for Hokkaido Landscape Photography Adventure. And we've just started taking bookings. They're already starting to sell, so don't hang around too long if you want to join us. But hopefully I'll see you there at this time next year. So thanks very much for listening today. If you enjoy this podcast, please share a link with your friends. And if you don't already, please subscribe in iTunes or your favorite podcast program to ensure uninterrupted delivery. You can find me on Google+, Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, etc. And links to everything that I'm up to are at martinbaileyphotography.com, so do drop by and take a look. I'll be back next week with an update on that Hokkaido landscape photography adventure. But in the meantime, you take care and have a great week, whatever you're doing. Bye-bye.